Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Science writer, communicator Léonie Joubert is fearless. Certainly not one to shy away from insurmountable topics like energy policies, the hunger-obesity conundrum, the crippling decline in public mental health. In fact, she actively interrogates and addresses them. But the real biggie, trumping all else, is climate change. Léonie's current story on how it's drastically impacting the Southern Kalahari is a piece for National Geographic, appearing in their August issue of 2021. But she describes it as a career Everest summit, and I asked her why.
So yes, in 2006, my very first book came out. I was a rookie science writer back then, and I put together a series of essays on how climate change was going to impact on different South African landscapes and species. And 17 years after that book comes out, you know, has a very small footprint, it lands on the desk of National Geographic magazine in Washington. And as a result of that, they invited me to write a story for them. So it's incredibly difficult to get into the magazine. It's by invite only, essentially. And one of their photographers had pitched a story about how climate change is going to impact on the Southern Kalahari, this very delicate ecosystem on the dunes. And they asked me if I would write the story. So I was so fortunate. I went up to the Southern Kalahari in the Northern Cape in October, November last year, at the end of what looks to be a multi-year drought, to just have a look at what the space looks like. It's the Tswalu Kalahari Reserve. And just tagged along with a whole bunch of different scientists, looking at pangolins, aardvark, Cape cobras, the social weaver birds, sociable weaver birds, just incredible. And the idea then is to tell the story of how changing temperatures and rainfall will impact on this very delicate weave of life. So if rainfall dries up, because the area is going to get much hotter and drier, if the rainfall reduces, how will that impact on the grass and the seeds, and then, of course, the ants and termites, and then animals like the pangolin that live off those animals. So the central character to this story is a pangolin. And it was extraordinary. My very first night out with these researchers looking for pangolins, I hoped that we would see one. I didn't expect we would. But they have a small number of these animals that have got these VHF tags on their rumps. And we were able to find one of their main study animals. And while we were quietly walking through the bush or through the dunes, following it after it had come out of its burrow, this animal stops and it turns around and it walks up to me and it sniffs my boot and then it wanders off again. It was the most remarkable experience. A pangolin sniffed my boot.
You are a marked woman.
I feel.
Well, you've been tagged yourself by National Geographic, which is quite something. But now you've been tagged by a pangolin, which is even more impressive. It feels like, never mind an article for National Geographic. Not that I'm diminishing it in any way, but it feels like a book. I mean, that's the title. You've got it, haven't you?
A pangolin sniffed my boot.
Exactly. But now, coming back to just what you've touched on sounds to me like an absolute life's work. Mm. Did they give you a word count? How does it work with National Geographic?
Yes, we agreed on a 3,000-word word count, which is very short. It's essentially two magazine features. The story is with Thomas Peshak, who's a very well-known photographer who has worked for National Geographic for over 10 years. And yes, they've given us quite an expansive spread in the magazine. But of course, you know, one could literally write a book on the extraordinary research being done there, funded by the Tswalu Foundation. Yeah, it's extraordinary work. And the whole area is facing quite dramatic change in future. You know, this part of Southern Africa is warming at twice the rate of the global average. And on its current trajectory, it's going to continue to warm faster than the rest of the world, which means the air is going to get a lot hotter and a lot drier. So whether these sort of remnant patches of Kalahari arid savanna will be able to survive in future, it's unlikely, to be honest. And within your and my lifetimes, we will probably see serious ecosystem collapse in the area. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in some of its reporting, has already said on its current trajectory within 50, 60 years, it'll be systems collapse.
Yeah, I'm shocked. I'm shocked. I think this is the thing about climate change. We know about these things, but we just have to put it away because it's just too big. But coming back to the story, so your hook is the pangolin, or your protagonist is the pangolin. But when you say it's going to have a huge impact on the ecosystem there, how will that ecosystem impact everything else? Because we do tend to think in terms of climate change, oh, well, it's over there. It's really not in my backyard. So what is the shadow of the climate change or climate change in the Kalahari?
It's a great way of framing the question. Also quite a difficult one to answer, because how far do we want to consider the shadow spreading? You know, the whole of that region as it dries. So the Southern Kalahari part that I was writing about is a reserve that's about 120,000 hectares in size, 119,000 to be precise. So that is itself an island of dry savanna. But what occurs on the outside of that? You know, you've got a lot of farmland. You have the Galagadi a little bit further north. You've got cities. You've got mining areas. I mean, so what the IPCC says is that cattle farming, for instance, which is really big across the much wider region, is likely to collapse. So the same is probably likely to happen for areas that carry game. You know, so yeah, I mean, answering the question is quite difficult.
Yeah.
Cities, any towns in the area will be severely water stressed. There are lots of mines in the area, but can they continue to draw on what water resources are there in order to keep functioning? So, you know, the ripple effects are enormous. Yeah. And
yeah, which makes it very difficult to be conclusive about anything. But what one can be is investigative. This may be equally difficult to answer. Is climate change as a result of climate change, or in this particular area in the Southern Kalahari, has it been accelerated by human activity?
So climate change everywhere is the result of
human activity.
Human activity. Mm. So you have this thickening layer of carbon pollution in the atmosphere, which pushes up the temperature of the atmosphere and the temperature of the ocean. That changes the amount of energy. So if you think of the ocean and atmosphere globally as this lung that breathes in and out and moves. It moves energy, it moves water in different ways. And then, of course, the way that movement expresses itself around the planet happens in different ways, in different regions. So some areas will possibly get wetter, some areas will get drier, most areas will get hotter. And of course, in this specific part of the planet, you will have it getting hotter and most likely drier. So you will have heat waves will impact animals, it will impact people, it will impact jobs, it will impact water availability, how water moves in the system, how heat moves in the system.
So, let's come back to the core of the story, which is the National Geographic story. What is the expression, how do you eat an elephant? You start at the foot and you work upwards. How are you going about putting all this into 3,000 words, given you Mr. Pangolin, who's, you know, the thread? How are you breaking it down? Or is it too soon to say, or are we going to jinx your story?
No, it's been the most remarkable writing experience. And this might speak to what we're going to chat about a little bit later, but what I found over the past while, particularly being desk-bound and computer-bound, is that my brain has become incredibly ADHD. You know, you just have this absolute barrage of information hurling itself at the windscreen all day. And I find it drives me to this very distracted, flighty thinking. And with long-form narrative writing like this, you need to immerse yourself in long periods of deep thinking. And when I discovered running when I was about 40, I suddenly realized how important flow state movement is for deep thinking and creative thinking. For instance, you know, lots of people say rock climbing or yoga or surfing does the same thing for them. And trail running on the mountain was that for me, where you drop into it and you forget what time it is, but your brain starts to knead the dough, so to speak. And I had found over the last few years, 2 years mostly, that I was not doing that anymore. And my brain was not functioning optimally. And I realized, so when I went up to the Kalahari in October, November, it was so hot for a period of time that my computer couldn't run. I would, between about 10 in the morning and the evening, the computer fan just ran so hard that I had to switch it off. So I had to go back to old school, long handwriting or shorthand writing to do transcriptions. It was slow and methodical. The temperature was so hot that we did most of our field research in the early morning or late evening. And again, that meant these long hours of sitting in my accommodation, just working slowly through reading, through writing. And very shortly before I went to the Kalahari, I had quit Facebook because for me, Facebook was just driving this ADHD behavior. So I was cold turkey, almost in a form of rehab while I was there. And what I saw the most remarkable thing happened. My brain just slowed down and settled. Through hours and hours of slow thinking, slow writing, my brain slowed down and then my nervous system calmed down. So instead of at the end of every day feeling wired, I would just feel calm. And that's why when I got back from the National Geographic trip, I went away on a little writing retreat and I sat for hours on a bench on this meditation veranda at this beautiful retreat, just good to be away from my office. And I sat literally cross-legged with my computer on my lap and weeks and weeks of notes and reading, longhand notes, transcriptions, academic papers, all mind mapped around me on this bench. And I just sat and wrote. And after 5 days of this writing process, I had probably 6,000, 7,000 words and a fantastic story arc. It was just there. It just happened. And I was on such a high after that. It was incredible. And then I sat down with my editor in Washington. His name is Oliver Payne, who's just an extraordinary man. He's been working with the magazine for 30 years. Wow. And he really, he's just a superb editor. And between us, we just slowly whittled it down. And then, of course, you have to kill your darlings, you know. So there were a lot of sections that we cut, and it was like having a little bit of a digit removed. But, you know, it was a great learning curve in terms of getting rid of verbosity, you know, saying what you mean. So, yes, it's been a sort of a six-month process of writing the text, working with the editor to get it down. And now we have something that's very close to ready to go to print.
Wow, that is such a journey that it warrants another book, a sort of handbook on how to do it. And the idea of going back to the old school, the handwritten word, and they do say that if you write through your hand, it comes straight from your head through your heart to your hand, as opposed to going through a machine. So it must have been extraordinarily authentic material that came out of this deep thinking. What an extraordinary lesson.
There was another sort of small little cog in all of this. Robert McFarlane, in his book, The Old Ways, he talks beautifully about the compact between walking and thinking. So he reflects on a number of different writers and philosophers and thinkers who used walking as a way to deal either with mental health challenges or else with the creative process. And he just summarizes perfectly what happens to your brain when you get into flow state movement, which is very much like the drawing process, which we're going to talk about a bit later. But one of the reasons I very briefly took up smoking again in the last 2 years, because it's been such a stressful period. And I realized that smoking was one of the last sort of blockages between me and getting back to flow state mountain running, and it was doing my brain no good. So I quit smoking so that I could get back onto the mountain into flow state movement.
What a lot of journeys you've been on.
It's been an interesting 2 years.
Yeah, my goodness me. If that's been your journey, I imagine that there are many other people who have perhaps been in similar positions, but haven't processed it in quite the same active, conscious way that you have done. Which brings me to the next thing, and I know it's one of the big subjects that you're quite concerned or very concerned about, is the state or the parlous state of public mental health as a result of so many different things. not least as a result of climate change. I mean, right now we sit in the middle of a pandemic, which is enormously stressful and having a frightening impact on the way people operate and the way they think. And I think leading towards depression, leading towards, you know, untimely deaths. So I'm not going to ask you how you think this can be changed, but what's your observation about generally the public state of mental health or the state of public mental health? Question A. Second part is, do you think climate change is impacting that? Or do you think people are putting climate change on the back burner because they can't deal with it?
It's a good question. And I think who is being impacted by, let's call it climate anxiety, that's one of the terms, yes, depends on who the person is and what community they live in. So in the South African context, public mental health is grossly underserviced. I mean, I don't have the figures immediately at hand, but something like 3 out of 4 people who need mental health treatment from the state are not able to get it, which just shows how this very serious health issue is neglected. You know, if you think of, if someone has a chronic heart disease or has insulin-dependent diabetes, that's a specific health condition that needs to be managed chronically. And mental health issues are just the same, but they often aren't viewed the same. Which, so many, many people, you know, who are not getting treatment when they should. And I think in the South African context, when you have so much poverty, the day-to-day emotional grind of trying to survive, I think, in fact, there's plenty of research to show how seriously that impacts people's, not just their well-being, but their mental health. So that's the one thing. I think in a country like South Africa, where you have generations of very severe trauma, you have this momentum building of ill health. And there's plenty of research to show the link between epigenetics. So, for instance, how your early childhood conditions, whether you're in the womb or those first early years, where your parents might be hyper-stressed and have their own mental health issues, that's going to switch on or switch off certain genes in yourself that will then possibly express themselves in your behaviors as an adult and is going to make you more prone to addiction. So, for instance, you will have a dopamine system in your brain, and Dr. Gabor Mate writes very comprehensively about this in his book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which explains how for an infant in utero and a young child, how their brain gets primed to seek out dopamine-stimulating behavior, whether it's in food or alcohol or nicotine or cocaine, all sorts of these kind of dopamine-feeding systems. So, for a lot of people who are born into trauma and pain and neglect, they are primed to become adults with certain addictive behaviors and mental health issues.
And I, as you quite rightly say, things like Facebook, social media in general, is certainly on that list of things that people will turn to. I know that solutions are very difficult, you know, whilst one tries to look at things in a positive frame. We can't solve climate change anytime soon or quickly. But in terms of the solutions to the state of public mental health, one can look at the state and the state of medicine and, you know, its lack of accessibility for most people. Or we can look within, rather as you've been describing your own journey of being outside, running, et cetera, you know, would you hazard to put together a few things that the average individual can do to help themselves cope with this stress?
So it's a good question. And maybe I should just also quickly touch on the climate collapse part of this, because I didn't quite answer that. So, yeah, I think, you know, just to add on to that about the climate collapse stuff, I think climate, it's more the worry of, you know, people who aren't trying to survive the day-to-day grind of poverty. So I think it's more likely to be sort of middle-class people who are more...
they've got time for it.
They've got time for it. And it's not because poorer people don't care. It's because poorer people have got bigger things to think about. But I certainly have seen in the climate change community, you know, people who are working with this stuff every day, it is becoming a very serious issue. I mean, you know, for me, the past 2 years have been really bad for my own health. And I mean that in terms of my mental health. You know, 2019 was the year that the climate truth bomb hit. You know, that's when we realized that things are much more serious than we thought. And I suddenly thought, I've been doing this for 20 years, you know, and the situation is worse, not better. Why do I keep getting out of bed every day for the next 20 years writing about something that is so depressing? I just, you know, and then COVID hits, and then I get locked into sort of solitary isolation for months and have this frontline view of just how much the system is collapsing. And it's terrifying. And, you know, so much time to think and ruminate. It's, and of course, not being able to do those key day-to-day things that are central to your emotional well-being. Yeah, my health took a real dip.
I just want to interject there, because please don't give up, and please don't think that 20 years have been wasted. It may have taken National Geographic 17 years to find your book, but they've found it. And it does mean that what you're doing is being recognized, and your books have not gone away. In fact, the book you were talking about, was it Scorched? Yeah. I mean, there've been a number of other books, but it still is relevant now, more so than it was then. So please don't give up. That was just a word of encouragement from my side. So going back to the mental health, what can be done? Thoughts on that?
So I can't really speak to the systemic stuff. You know, how does the South African healthcare system address this? But certainly, I think what I and the kinds of things that work for me, I'm privileged enough as a relatively well-resourced South African to be able to do this. So I appreciate that for many people, it's not possible. You know, if you're living in an informal settlement, you cannot do the kinds of things that I do to maintain health. But I have realized mental health, it's a little bit like flying an aeroplane. You know, you've got this huge, you're a pilot, you've got this huge dashboard in front of you, and you've got all of these little knobs and pulleys and levers that you need to constantly tweak in order to keep the aeroplane sort of stable, so that when you do hit a really bad patch of turbulence, you can, it's going to wobble the plane, but you can tweak these knobs. And for me, the dials that need to be turning are, you know, every day it needs to involve getting away from my desk and moving my body, not to burn calories, but to burn off the anxiety in my body, which sometimes, because I do have chronic anxiety, so sometimes it feels like having second-degree burns on the inside of my chest. And if I don't move my body, I don't get rid of that pain. I guess it's eating healthily and in a conscious, regulated way. I have to be very careful with alcohol. For me, that's a particularly dangerous drug. And I think for many people with anxiety issues, it is. I think cannabis is possibly a safer drug for people like myself, which I very occasionally use. And then, you know, I see a therapist from time to time, which really works. I read books that are edifying. I read stories that are edifying. I hang out with friends that are really edifying, you know, people who I connect with. That's a wonderful thing. Just being in nature. And then I, bizarrely enough, discovered and picked up drawing shortly before lockdown, which, when I no longer had running as an option to get into flow state, I discovered that drawing was an extraordinary way to get into flow state. And that's something we can talk about. But then, of course, as you also know, the one thing I've been very interested in terms of dealing with mental health is the opportunity to use psychedelic-assisted therapy as a way to treat certain depression, anxiety, end-of-life anxiety, and then certain behaviors that are quite addictive and sort of on these negative feedback loops. And as you know, with the Psychonauts, this podcast that I started about 2 or 3 years ago, it very much uses long-form storytelling to look at people who are already experimenting with this as a method, but also tying it in with the science that we're getting from interesting places like Imperial College London, Johns Hopkins University, New York University, many other universities who are doing clinical trials in the use of things like psilocybin, which is from mushrooms, and MDMA, which technically isn't a psychedelic, but has quite similar impacts, and various other psychedelics. And it works very differently to taking an antidepressant like an SSRI. But it's a fascinating field of research. It's not new. It was being used by scientists in the 30s and 40s, and they had very astonishing findings. Essentially, it's now being revived. Some of the stigma is being taken away from these drugs. They were just banned in the 1960s because the Nixon administration was seriously threatened by the anti-war movement because, you know, there were so many people that were pushing back against the Vietnam War, and these substances were associated with that counterculture, which is why they were banned. But this really, for instance, psilocybin is being compared to the discovery of penicillin in terms of its applicability for treating mental health. It does require very specific training from therapists. It requires people to take these substances in a supervised context with very specific skills. It's not a magic bullet, but really the potential as a mental health treatment that can be rolled out affordably at scale is very exciting. The mental health community that are at the forefront of this are extremely excited about the opportunities. So that's, I think, one of my little areas of activism has been to try and get the South African community talking about this.
Yeah, and it's a very supportive role that you've taken on there, because I'm just thinking that the people who you feature in the Psychonauts podcast, and I think people can find that at psychonauts.co.za is the podcast. The people who you feature must perhaps, I'm assuming here, benefit from being able to tell, to share their story. Do you find that, I mean, in some ways you've taken on the psychologist role yourself, or at least the listener role, and perhaps the listening role is a valuable one for them?
Well, in fact, Nancy, I think you more than anyone would understand the importance of listening to people's stories, because that's your entire life's work has been that. There is something remarkable about listening to people, giving them a chance to speak. And, you know, whether people are speaking to a psychologist or a friend or, you know, a religious leader or a storyteller, it's an opportunity for people to make sense of their lives and feel normal. You know, I think if you ask most people, do you feel usual and unusual? Most people will probably say unusual, because they feel like they somehow are hovering on the edge of what is normal. There is no normal, really.
Completely.
So I don't know if I've filled that sort of psychologist role, but I certainly think there are a lot of people out there who have been using psilocybin and similar substances to treat their mental health, have seen such remarkable breakthroughs, and are so excited about it that they want to share their experience with others. And I think that's why this has been such a lovely opportunity.
Yeah, wow. Psychonauts.co.za. Psychonauts is P-S-Y-C-H-O-N-A-U-T-S. Is that right?
Yes.
However, there's not been a lot of listening. There's not been so much experience sharing during the COVID pandemic, but simply because a lot of people have been isolated. We seem to be moving out of that phase, but we need to be moving back into it I think we need to be very careful, because it's still very much out there. So it means a lot of people have had a lot of time by themselves, not least yourself, as you described there. And whilst writing has been enormously beneficial for you and for the rest of the world because of the content of what you're writing, the drawing has been extraordinary. How did it start? Did you know that you had, because your drawings are superb and getting better, if I may say, how did you discover this talent and how have you been using it?
Oh, thank you, Nancy. That's so lovely. You know, it's interesting, at school, art was one of the subjects I did at school. And I really did not do well at school. I almost failed matric, not because I'm necessarily stupid, but because I was just struggling emotionally. So my marks were terrible. And I took a number of years off after school to travel and just try and figure out how to survive as an adult. And eventually I ended up at university, and I tried fine art for a year, because it was the only thing I remember being vaguely okay at school. And 6 months into standing in the studio drawing, I just realized this was not for me. And I switched over to history and journalism. And I mean, once or twice over the years, I would pick up a pencil and just do a little sketch. But I never really thought there was any aptitude there. Incidentally, when I went on my very first research trip for the first book, which was down to Marion Island in the subantarctic, I wrote a little sort of personal journal every day in addition to the journalistic notes. And I scribbled all sorts of little drawings into this journal just for fun. And looking back at that now, all these years later, these very rough sketches of penguins and the subantarctic gear I had to wear and the island, and they're just remarkable little vignettes, really. But I really didn't sort of pick up on it at all after that. And I don't know what happened, but I think I just wanted to pick up natural history drawings or try my hand at natural history drawing. And I was, yeah, as I said, the last 2 weeks have been really difficult, 2 years have been really difficult. And I thought I need something, a hobby that is not sitting at a desk writing and working with words, because that's just heavy lifting a lot of the time. So I bought a little, some art pads, and I found this remarkable online course run by an Australian university that take you through some of the basics. And I did about 4 or 5 sketches, and I thought, my goodness, that actually looks like the thing I was trying to draw. And then, so that happened in about the month or two leading up to COVID, and then suddenly lockdown happens. And wow, I suddenly, you know, being trapped in this tiny little flat on my own, not being able to run every day, I started to think I was going slightly mad. And a very dear friend introduced me to her daughter, Rebecca Haysom, who started running online drawing courses. Rebecca is an artist herself, just the most remarkable drawing courses, which are designed specifically around mindfulness and meditation. And the idea with her drawing is that you're not trying to draw the perfect picture. You're just trying to slow down, pause, observe, and have a conversation with the scene in front of you. And I just threw myself into these courses. And it was just wonderful that there was no expectation. You didn't have to draw a good picture. You just had to create this thing. And this remarkable series of drawings just unfolded. And through lockdown, I would just sit at my dining room table for hours every night, listening to audiobooks or else listening to podcasts and just letting these pictures unfold. It was extraordinarily rewarding. And then I started to realize that there's this opportunity to let some of the politics of my work come through in the drawing. So one of the series of pictures that I did is, it's a 6-part series of sort of illustrations that try to demonstrate the relationship. Basically, it's called Hitmen. And it, or Hit Me, Hit Men. And basically, it's trying to demonstrate that how addiction works and who is profiting off of addiction. So it's showing the link between sugar, alcohol, cocaine, nicotine, social media, and how big corporate businesses have kind of profited off of the corporate capture of our dopamine system. So that was it was fun. I mean, it's not something I've had published anywhere except on my website. It's very quirky and unusual, but it was such a creatively stimulating process, and it felt for me politically quite potent.
This is so the moment to give out your website, which is leoniejoubert.co.za, leoniejoubert.co.za.
That's right.
On that note, I have just one last question. I'm thinking I'm going back to the pangolin sniffing your boot. Have you drawn a pangolin?
I have indeed. And in fact, I will send you a picture of it. Yes, I drew a picture of the exact pangolin that sniffed my boot.
Leonie Joubert, it's been the most flow state conversation I think I can ever remember having. We've gone from the Kalahari to mushrooms to pangolins to the perfect picture. Fascinating. www.leoniejoubert.co.za. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you.